My name is Mark Seeley. I'm a board member for the CCC and formerly a publishing lawyer. In that context, I had the privilege of working with both Jessica Sanger of the German Publishers Association, the Börsenverein, and with Carlos Scala-Lavazzari, who's a partner at the Swiss law firm Lenz Kammerer, and also of counsel to the STM Association and various other rights organizations. Both Carla and Jessica, by the way, Jessica's title at the Börsenverein is legal counsel and director of European and international affairs, and just recently announced as the chair of the coverage committee for the International Publishers Association. So as you can tell from the introduction, both Carla and Jessica have a lot of information about what's been happening in copyright law developments in Europe, in particular with the digital single market proposal, and can really provide us a lot of background. Basically, what DSM is about is the updating of the digital copyright laws for the European Union. And the last time that was really done was in 2001. This is a very big law. It covers a lot of different issues. Issues about copyright exceptions and limitations and how those are harmonized across the European member states. Also taking a new look at the question of how the online market should actually operate in terms of copyrighted content being shared on internet sites. And then a lot of information about transparency for remuneration for digital uses. And there are other factors as well. As you can see on this next chart, we've identified a number of areas of exceptions. Some of these questions about fair play for both news content and the online content sharing sites. Discussions about collective management organization revenues and the relationship between authors and publishers. And finally, a lot of discussions on the transparency for contract law. Today, what we're going to talk about are we're going to deal with all of the exceptions. We're going to deal with one of the fair play elements, the online content sharing platform. And we're going to talk about the CMO revenues. We're not going to go into detail on the transparency issues and contract law, just for sort of consideration of time. I think it's fair to say on those latter points that a lot of the experience that some member states have in looking at contracts between authors, performers, and publishers and producers are being reflected in the DSM. So what I'd like to do now with that general introduction is to ask Carlo to talk us through that first exception on text and data mining.
So yes, if you look at the next slide that will show one of two text and data mining exceptions that the Digital Single Market Directive has enacted at European level. The member states of the European Union will now have 2 years to implement this exception. Text and data mining is used commonplace these days in all kinds of analysis of text works. It is often in science the case that people will use text tools to identify content that they later want to analyze and read in detail. So the STM Association, one of my clients, brings together some 120 publishers in the world that publish, including social science, that is heavily used through text and data mining technologies. And as a result, these publishers also offer services so collectively with the CCC, among others, for use by libraries, institutions, and by corporate users and their researchers. What the first of the two exceptions has done is to say, okay, under what circumstances is it okay without authorization to text and data mine works to which already has lawful access to. So the issue is not about first obtaining access to works that the user has identified. They are subscribing or otherwise buying access to the works in question and want to make an additional use, in this case of text and data mining. And the exception that member states now have to introduce draws the line at the beneficiary level, as research institutions, which chiefly are public institutions. It could also in some cases be privately funded institutions' mission. And the text and data mining exception provides some safeguards to avoid that this exception becomes a gate for abuses. And so they are restrictions that content owners, publishers can impose on how the content on their platforms is accessed. And this should ideally be done in consultation with the users to make sure the platforms remain stable, but the users get as to the works that they want to text and data mine. To give an illustration, you could have researchers that want to find out the latest in diabetes, identified 16,000 articles of diabetes with that topic across 50 different publishers, to which at a large institution, maybe TIB in Germany, they do have access to. And if they have the necessary subscriptions, they can, through Crossref, access relevant information and mass download and text and data mine in an agreed protocol. They can store the information, but they should avoid storing information so that other users can access for free the very same content. I think that's not asking for too much. The deals with another second text and data mining exception scenario. And if you go to the next slide, you can there look at content that is available on the open internet. And there the restrictions are far less, but at the same time, to balance this exception, it is going to be possible for rights holders to say, actually, provide licensed access. This is my market. Yes, this content sits on the open internet for reading, but if people want to text and data mine, they have to either license from me directly or via collective licensing mechanisms these uses. So this is effectively an opt-out by notice mechanism. So it is to be anticipated that user rights owners will agree the format of these notices that effectively amount to an opt-out and then enable licensing. Again, the issue of stability of platforms is there, and safeguarding measures are allowed these platforms of publishers crashing. At this point, I think I would leave it at this summary, but I'm happy to delve deeper into the topic. Mark?
Yeah, I thought we might next turn to the other exceptions. Go ahead, Jessica.
Thank you very much. I'll be talking about the next two exceptions that were introduced into this directive. As Mark said initially, it is quite a mixed bag of different areas that this directive covers. And the next one we're going to be talking about, here we are, the exception in new Article 5 of the directive is about illustration for teaching. This is the kind of exception that we've known across Europe in various slightly differing versions in the different member states. And here the issue that the directive is trying to address is the question of students being able to access learning materials that they need for whichever course they're enrolled in, or pupils from schools, whatever their teacher is making available for them to use for homework and other purposes directly involved with teaching activities across borders. So the point the directive was trying to fix, if you like, was situations where whoever was learning might be located in another member state, a member state other than that in which the school, university, or other teaching educational institution was located. So the beneficiaries here are the educational establishments. I've already described the purpose that this exception covers, and it explicitly covers digital use rather than analog uses for fairly obvious reasons. And it must be a non-commercial teaching activity. So this does not give any benefits to private schools or universities, perhaps, that are not not-for-profit. The caveats are that the uses have to take place in somehow a secure environment. So the teaching needs to be happening either at the school or university or at another venue, but under their responsibility. And the exception also requires a secure electronic environment for reproduction, distribution, and making available of the content. And a very important caveat also that isn't directly mentioned in the article itself, but that we can deduce from the article, is that only extracts or very short works may be used. The article itself speaks of the extent necessary for the purpose of illustration for teaching here, and the understanding is, and that is elaborated on a little bit in one of the recitals that comes with the directive, that you won't need to provide, say, an entire novel, even if pupils are perhaps reading the entire novel for a school assignment, but it won't be necessary to provide a full novel for the purposes of illustration for teaching. So that caveat is put in place, obviously, to diminish the impact on sales of those books. Regarding the moral rights of the author, there is a requirement that the source and the author's name must be given whenever extracts or short works are used, unless that's technically not feasible, but in most cases I think that won't cause a serious concern. Another important aspect to this article is that certain ways of dealing with the typical illustration for teaching scenarios that have been common in certain member states across Europe. So the kinds of exceptions that have been operating over the last decades in many European countries have been quite different, but they have, some of them had certain features in common. And one of those common features in some countries has been that the materials used for the purposes of illustration for teaching under an exception may not be actual school books. So, for instance, in Germany and France, there was a carve-out for school books. So you could use an extract from a novel. You could use a poem, maybe, or a short piece of music, for instance. But you would not be able to use a product that is designed specifically for teaching purposes. This obviously, again, is to avoid teachers just collating bits and pieces from different school books and thereby entirely replacing a school book that actually would need to be acquired by pupils or students for the purpose of attending that course. So that's a possibility that member states have. They can also exclude certain uses when they adopt the exception. And this shows how there is a certain degree of harmonization here. So everything I've described before this point is mandatory for member states to introduce. But on this point of whether or not they're going to have a carve out for school books or certain uses, this is where member states have discretion. So it's not full harmonization at European level. There will still be differences between the different member states. And another area where member states have a choice, somewhat unfortunately, we would have preferred for this also to have been mandatory, is the question as to whether this exception will be a remunerated exception. So an exception where, for instance, collective management organizations will be able to collect payments for the uses and distribute those to rights holders afterwards. So that's Article 5, illustration for teaching, and there is one more exception that I'd like to present to you now, Article 6. Much shorter exception. It allows cultural heritage institutions to make reproductions for the purposes of preservation of works that they have permanently housed in their collections. There's no restriction in terms of which format or medium they may use, but the material has to be something they own, and they can only reproduce it. So there's no making available or further distribution permitted by this exception. It is purely for the purpose of preservation. It doesn't. The directive doesn't directly require there to be, for instance, a physical copy that is in danger of disintegrating, or they don't actually have to show that, but the exception is strictly limited to the purpose of preservation. And again, we have the caveat that whatever they're going to do with it, the cultural heritage institutions may only be what is necessary for this purpose. The beneficiaries are not entirely limited, say, to national libraries, which are endowed with the specific function of preserving cultural heritage, so libraries that would receive legal deposit collections, but other libraries and archives may also make use of this exception. Okay, I suppose we should be moving on. There is another area the directive tackles, which has been a challenge over the last few years. The idea that libraries have collections of works, many of which are long out of print. So they've fallen out of commerce. They're no longer being exploited in the market. So the big question, are the libraries able to digitize this content and make it available? And I'm talking, of course, about works that are still under copyright, so not works that have fallen out of copyright, but those where nobody is exploiting them at the moment, but copyright still would prevent libraries just going ahead and putting them, scanning books, for instance, and putting them online. So the directive tackles this, first of all, by way of collective licensing. So cultural heritage institutions can ask collective management organizations for a license, which will be a non-exclusive license, and will permit reproduction and giving access online to works which are out of commerce. And again, we have here a limitation to non-commercial purposes. So nobody can build a business model on this, but libraries who are operating in the public interest with a public interest mandate would be able to put those works online and make them accessible for their readers, again, if they, the works are part of the permanent collection. The way this works is that, of course, it's very difficult to ascertain whether all the rights holders of all these works, which are long out of commerce, so nobody knows perhaps even exactly who the rights holder is on which work, it will be very hard to ascertain that all of them were actually active members of certain collective management organizations. So what happens here, the mechanism employed is what we refer to as extended collective licensing, where the mandate of the collective management organization, which has been granted by a large number of, say, fiction authors for the works of fiction, and their publishers has been granted to this collective management organization, this mandate is then extended to those authors of the same type, of works of the same type, potentially probably in the same territory, by way of presumption. So the assumption is made that all authors and publishers are covered of this type of work, this category, you might say, of work, are covered by the mandate to the collective management organization. And of course, that means, since they aren't technically all covered, that they must have a possibility for an opt-out, that rights holders must be warned ahead of the use, before the use actually takes place, and before, for instance, a book is digitized and made available online, make certain that they have the possibility, at least in theory, to find out that this is going to happen and to say, I don't want that to happen, or later to show up and say, hold on, I don't want my work used in that way. So that's something that's been used a lot in the Nordic countries. I think extended collective licensing was invented in Norway, as far as I know, and has been extensively used on the basis of agreements between organizations representing publishers and authors and the users for large-scale digitization projects and similar purposes. So this is where this is being broadened more or less to the European level for out-of-commerce works. And of course, there are a lot of questions around what which works are actually going to be out-of-commerce. What requirements are there to ascertain that? And that will be a lot of the nitty-gritty around implementing this kind of provision at national level. So moving on to the next way of dealing with the challenge of works that are out of commerce. This is something that will not apply to books and periodicals, probably in many areas, because there is a fallback exception foreseen for cases in which there is no collective management organization in existence that is sufficiently representative of the category of works in question. And we are in the fortunate position where for most of the rights holders that we represent as publishing, there are going to be collective management organizations in place. And this exception explicitly does not kick in where, for instance, they just haven't been able to conclude an agreement. So if the library and the CMO couldn't agree under the scenario of extended collective licensing that I've just described, the library would not be able to fall back on the exception. That would only be possible, as I say, in cases where there is no such CMO, just from the nature of the works we're looking at. So otherwise, it's a very similar provision. And the light blue box on the right down there just serves as a reminder that both these provisions, the extended collective licensing and the fallback exception, don't apply where, let's say, most of the works that they're looking to digitize and make available, so a certain set of works, another nice question, what exactly is a set? But we can sort of imagine a collection or a part of a collection in a library to be a set, where that is from third countries, so where the rights holders are not from the EU, they would probably not be affected by this. Now, I'm skipping
Jessica,
to... Yes, sorry?
Yeah, I was just going to say, before we move on to the CMO discussion, there was one question about Article 14 and the reproduction.
Oh, yes, I'm just seeing that.
Works in the public domain.
Mm.
Do you have a comment about that?
Well, that's just a clarification, I would say, but not something I've been working on a lot. But this is where the term of protection has expired. So we're looking at the situation where a work has actually entered the public domain. So if that work is then reproduced, this provision ensures that there will not be a new protection of copyright or related rights on this work just by dint of having being reproduced by someone, unless, of course, there is an active creative, input. So unless the reproduction itself is not a pure reproduction, but there's somehow an added creative value to what comes out of the reproduction. And that's actually quite important where works that are in the public domain, for instance, paintings are reproduced in commercial publications. This adds a degree of certainty for that company exploiting those works, that there isn't going to be somebody else showing up and claiming that because they reproduced the work, they now have a right in it. Does that help at all?
I hope so.
Okay, perhaps if everybody's happy with that on the exceptions, I'd like to move on to a slightly unusual animal, if I may say, in this directive. It's Article 16, formerly known as Article 12 in the draft version. And this provision sets out, which is already unusual, sets out to rectify something that the European Court of Justice, CJEU, brought upon us in its judgment from 2015 on the HP Reprobel case. And we obviously don't have time to go into loads of detail here, but in a very, very short condensed form, I could say that HP Reprobel case said that publishers were not rights holders. Now, you might ask, what else are they? Which are their assets if they're not actually holders of copyright-related rights? But CJEU was talking about rights holders under a certain article of another directive. And for the reason that they were not considered rights holders in that specific context, publishers were then excluded from, well, certain benefits under collective management. So in Germany, the way that case, the HP Reprobel case, was interpreted by the German Supreme Court, very unfortunate, the fact that there was a case related to these aspects afoot at that specific point in time at the German Supreme Court, and they took HP Reprobel on board, led to, well, hundreds of millions of euros being requested back from publishers, from various collective management organizations, because they were found to have been illegally distributing collective management revenue to publishers, because if publishers couldn't be rights holders, they certainly couldn't have a share in collective management revenues from uses under exceptions. That's quite a complicated field. I won't go into it any further. The point is that this directive sets out to fix the problem, and that's really, really important to us, especially here in Germany, since we were the unlucky ones who were directly impacted very quickly by this decision. And the basically, Article 16 permits member states to go ahead and organize themselves or organize their copyright law in a way that they can give publishers a share in collective management revenues. They can either maintain the rules they already had or reintroduce this publisher share by way of new rules. There's no restriction there. This was important to us because our entire system has changed since then, and the recital that comes with this article isn't brilliant in terms of clarity, and it shows the political battle that was waged in the background. Again, something we don't have time to talk about now, but that is intriguing in itself. So we look forward now in Germany to being able to repair the damage, and I think that's the important point. We're going to be able to reinstate a publisher share in collective management. This affects uses, for instance, like for illustration for teaching that I was talking about earlier, for various other exceptions, and also library lending revenues have been lost. And we aim to be able to put that back in place. So if the law comes into force at national level this year, then publishers will be able to receive money again next year. And that's very important to many of our members, especially smaller publishers, particularly in the academic area where collective management distributions are higher than in other areas. So that's a great relief. And with on that positive note, I think I'm handing back to Mark at this point.
Thank you very much, Jessica. We do have a retroactivity question, which actually might broadly apply to some other provisions as well. But before we get there, I think we should go back to Carlo and have a good discussion about the online safe harbor platform responsibility question.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, I would say that this provision during the negotiations, but is now in the final version, Article 17, was one of the most controversial provisions in this directive for till the very end, I would say the last second even. The issue is that both in the US and in Europe around the millennium, rules were made to give legal certainty to internet service providers, and they've resulted in what many listeners will know as the safe harbors, the provisions that if internet service providers, be that access providers, search engines, are acting in a mere conduit capacity and react to notice and takedown speedily, that they can be not, that they can remove themselves from any discussion of copyright infringement, and that will be a discussion merely between the copyright owner and the user of the internet service provider service. Now, since the millennium, the services have evolved and the technology also has evolved so that places internet service providers and online content service providers in a different context from that anyone could have imagined. And in particular, the music industry that was and continues to be reliant on those service providers for the distribution and dissemination of music has felt that the balance of power was unequal in terms of the safe harbor number one. That is one set of imbalances, that the service providers weren't doing piracy and pirated content, of which Pirate Bay is probably the poster child nowadays. In the olden days, there were the Napster wars. But the second imbalance was a lack of enthusiasm, would I say, by platforms to engage in honest licensing discussions with the music owners chiefly. And this directive, sort of 20 years later, says it is actually time to recognize that the market has moved on, that the platforms play a pivotal role, and to move from a safe harbor to a platform co-responsibility scenario. So addressing these two issues, there is an obligation on platforms to enter licensing agreements where they are offered, and that is chiefly the case in music, sometimes also for text-based works, and maybe rarely so at this point for the film audiovisual sector. There is also a responsibility where, in fact, no licensing is offered by rights holders, but content platforms have a duty of care that is legislated here to ensure that their users deal mainly in legal content. And here, rights holders and platforms are encouraged to collaborate, whereby rights holders would pre-identify works and provide information to the platforms to enable them to host compliant content, content that is perfectly legal to distribute by uploaders via those platforms. And there are various safeguards in the interest of the free flow of ideas that should result in rights holders not asking platforms to block more than is necessary. And that you can see on the slide there that there are safeguards against sort of monitoring in general of automated blocking or of going up against the freedom of speech and quotations. If you move the slide, Mark, to the next one, you can see, in fact, more of those safeguards and that are enshrined in the new Article 17. And probably one of the most important one is that, in fact, uploaders under any licensing deal are covered for their non-commercial uses. So this would bring us back almost into the pre-internet area where licensing was a matter for the professionals. As a private user of the internet, where my licensing platform or internet service provider is licensed, I do not actually have that much to do anymore with content I can upload and share. Obviously, there are privacy issues also to be addressed, and there are rules introduced that make sure exceptions from copyright protection can still be relied on even in this new world of co-responsibility of platforms and copyright owners. If you can move the slide to the next slide, you will see that there are a fair number of issues that still have to be worked out in detail in stakeholder consultations or in guidance from the Commission of how exactly this provision will deal with some of the exercise of rights of quotation or criticism and review parody, while others, I think the exclusion of open source software platforms has not been controversial. Wikipedia also has been, in fact, excluded from the ambit of this Article 17, which is interesting to note because Wikipedia itself tried to influence the lawmaking process through various blackouts in various countries at the time this law was made. You can also see platforms that chiefly deal in the buying and selling, such as eBay, benefit from an exclusion. And one temporary exclusion, if you will, is that one of micro and small and medium-sized enterprises that in the first 3 years and below certain thresholds benefit from an exclusion of having to collaborate with rights holders. I think the model for all of these collaborations will, in effect, be YouTube, the elephant in the room. And with that intro on Article 17, Mark, perhaps there are questions or comments either from you or the audience.
I think one question that did come up earlier had to do with retroactivity. So to what extent, we're looking at a two-year implementation period for member states, but are any of the provisions, or would any of those provisions apply retroactively? any of the ones we've talked about today?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and I would say at least in German we even speak of anticipated effectiveness. You can say that there are in fact two cases pending in the Court of Justice, one uploaded, known as the Elsevier case. It's really five different cases against the platform that is known as Uploaded, and then there is the YouTube case. And it may very well be that these cases, even though they are pending already, will to some extent be influenced by the passage of this directive. I think strictly there will be no retroactivity in the sense that these new rules apply to past events or events taking place in the next 2 years until full implementation. But it is highly likely that judges will take into account the expressed lawmakers' intention of how platforms and rights holders should relate to each other in future. Mark?
I think, if
Thanks,
I may
Carla.
Add, sorry.
Go ahead, Jessica.
Sorry. I think Carla is absolutely right in terms of what ongoing litigation, especially in the area he is referring to, are concerned. Specifically, I think the question was around Article 14, and there Article 26 actually tells us that it will apply, the entire directive will apply to works and other subject matter protected by national law on or after 7 June 2021. So that's technically the actual date by which these things must take effect.
Thank you, Jessica. We have a couple of questions about platforms. So one is an example of a purely passive platform. So Carla, do you have a good example?
Of a purely passive platform?
Perhaps a cloud service which a user is working their personal files on?
That's right. So a Dropbox would come to mind, or any other cloud service that does not engage in publicly making works available, but is simply a storage space for users, is an example. Service providers that are access providers only, again, will be deemed purely passive, even though they're not even part of the definition of OSSP here.
And then there's a related question, Carlo, about uploading and downloading, which I think is related to this matter. YouTube wouldn't be liable if, in fact, the platform was simply being used by a user in that passive manner that we just described, like a cloud service. So the question is going to be when they're communicating to third parties.
That's right. So in fact, the Article 17 clarifies that where a platform engages in active organization, marketing or selection of content and making it more useful, it all goes back to the eBay and the L'Oreal cases of the Court of Justice, where active platforms or non-passive platforms were defined behavior. So that those behaviors are kind of codified now by this Article 17 and indicate that if you engage in such activity, then you are deemed to communicate to the public. So you become, in fact, co-liable with the person who uploads. Mark?
Very good. And Jessica, you made a comment as well on the offer being made.
Yes, I think the point is not whether it's streaming or upload or download. It's more about what is, as Carlo just described, really, what is the service, this platform actually doing with the content? Is it directing users to certain things and that definitely would be the case with YouTube. Is it somehow curating this content? Is it making it more attractive? How is it organizing the content that is there? So it's not just a parking space or, a repository that does nothing about the content, but it's basing a business model, a commercial business model, on organizing and making available the content.
Good. Thank you very much. I want to thank both our speakers. These are folks that have obviously spent a lot of time on these issues, a lot of time in Brussels, and it's been incredibly helpful to get their direct experience on those points.